You are listening to the Massive Report podcast.
Last version. We started this a couple weeks ago. We've updated how we're doing the Massive Report podcast here, as we obviously don't have any crew games or soccer in general, sports at all to talk about. So we're doing things a little bit different. If you missed our show last time, Sam Fahmy and I just discussed kind of how we got involved with the crew, how we got involved with soccer. Now we're bringing another member of the Massive Report staff on it with Patrick Goldman, who's our managing editor and kind of keeps us in line. Patrick, how you doing?
Not too bad tonight, really. It's, you know, it's all things considered, you know, doing all right.
Yeah, and Sam also here. I'm sure Sam, you will chime in throughout as we go through some stories and talk about various things that have to do with Mass Report, with the crew, all that type of stuff like we did last time. But first, you know, I think a lot of people are still, you know, we're what, 4 weeks into this, a few weeks into the stay-at-home orders around Ohio. How are you guys handling this? Obviously, both of you are now working from home. Both of you have kids that need to be taken care of. Patrick, start with you. Just what's your daily routine like now that life is not as it normally is?
It's trying to organize the chaos, really. My wife is actually doing telemedicine at home. She's a social worker. So she has carved out a impromptu office in our bedroom. And then, it's the furthest away from everybody else. I have now decamped to our basement, which is not finished. So I have a little desk in the corner. Do my work from down here, and then the kids kind of float throughout the day. We try to keep to a schedule so that when screen time is and when to try to get outside and try to take time throughout the day to do walks or work with them, because my daughter has already completed all of her homework that she has that she thought was for last week, but it's also actually for this week because the stuff for last week didn't count. My son, he just really wants to play Zelda. So that is trying to keep everybody on track and balance things out while we are all four of us are at home. And it's just, the challenge everybody's facing.
Sam, what about you? Sound fairly similar to what's going on at your house?
Yeah, except that my kids are older and fairly self-sufficient, and I live in a house of introverts, and I'm the only extrovert. So, but, you know, luckily for me, since I have to do a lot of video and audio production, I have to run into the office maybe once or twice a week. But I've actually been working from home technically for 3 weeks now. It's not new, but it's starting to get old, if you know what I mean. It's just, for people that are extrovert like me, that like to go out, that are also like, you know, high fivers and huggers and stuff like that. Right. This is a tough time for us. But yeah, I mean, I can do most of my work from here, and, the kids are doing their schoolwork when they feel like it, as long as it gets done on time. And, my wife is, you know, also in school. So she has, her classes have already been meeting online all semester. So this wasn't really too much of a change.
Yeah. It's, you know, interesting for me. I don't have kids. I'm not married, but I do live with my girlfriend. And it's funny because, you know, when this all started, we didn't think, and I think Sam and I talked about this last week or last time a little bit, but you know, we didn't think our lives would change too much. I work from home anyway, and she's a nurse, so she's still going to work, and fortunately hasn't been exposed to anything crazy yet. But what we've noticed, the big difference has been just, for me, not having, you know, the practices or interviews to go to during the day. You know, for her, she's just kind of, you know, calm before the storm, before things get get messy over at the James where she works. So yeah, it hasn't been too crazy and different from my perspective, but I have noticed the difference in terms of amount of time at home as opposed to normal. And then, you know, as Sam said, just kind of the social aspect of it, not being able to see people in person and whatnot. You know, I have seen a couple people in, you know, social distance settings, but it's been very limited, which for me has been a challenge, but, you know, we're doing what we can. But anyway,
yeah, if you didn't see, Ralph and I actually went taking pictures because it was a gorgeous day yesterday and we kind of social distance pretty much the whole time. And not that we don't social distance anyway in normal settings, but yeah, it was even that much more. Everybody was kind of fairly conscious, but
yeah, I rode my bike. I was just out for a bike ride the other day. I think it was yesterday or Friday, one of the two. I found myself downtown. So I rode down by the new stadium construction just to kind of see where it was. You couldn't see much, obviously, the fences they have up and around, but definitely the dispatch had some pictures they put out yesterday from a higher vantage point and certainly making some headway on that stadium. I don't know when or how much they've been able to work on it the past couple weeks. I know when I talked to Bez and I wrote about this, that they're planning to still have things, you know, on time for the opening of the stadium still next summer, but we'll see how it goes. So let's move away from kind of the coronavirus issues and talk a little bit about the crew and Massive Report. Sam and I talked last time about Massive Report came together, but Patrick, you were also involved in that. So let's start, I guess, first before we get into that, just your involvement with soccer, your involvement with the crew, where that all came from, and how you initially got involved as a crew fan before you even got involved on the writing side.
So I think I went to my first game in 2002. I remember watching. I actually have been to every USA Mexico game in Columbus except for the first one.
Me too. I realized that the other day.
I realized, oh, that game's in town. Oh, you know, that would have been fun to go to. And then it was on TV when I realized that it was actually happening. So, went to, got some cheap tickets and went to a New England crew game. I want to say May of 2002 and, sat on the west sidelines there and don't remember the exact details of that game. It was an enjoyable time. I had lots of fun with my friends and my wife came. And we went to several other games, and one of the other games that happened to be that year was the Open Cup, which they just had on YouTube. You can now see the full game, at least for now. And I remember it being colder than what it apparently was. But yeah, it's 2002, I went to some games. I went through 2003, went to the opener in 2003. That was cold and rainy. 2004 was cold and rainy for the opener. Or 2005 was cold and rainy for the opener. And went to so many games that made sense to get season tickets. And I got season tickets for the second half of the 2005 season. And I had season tickets through 2005 through 2008. And went to just about every game through some terrible times. And then, of course, the championship season. I moved into writing about the team in 2008, uncredentialed. The blog's still out there, actually. And you can, I often sometimes look back on what I was writing. And I had some high hopes for that 2008 team, actually. When I look back, it's like, hey, there could be something if Alejandro Moreno figures out how to, score the goals they did against Toronto that first game. If some other people chip in goals, this team could really make some noise. And little did I realize. 2008, I think for a lot of people, is a turning point because that's when I met Sam, actually, down in the very dank and nasty basement of Ruby Tuesdays.
Back in the leaky days.
Yeah. I crossed paths with him online because I didn't have any photos, and he was taking the best photos out there. And so we chatted and became fast friends. And I think we were even at the same event where Ziggy got the scarf from the supporters group for the season. We were down there and he was holding court with the coaching staff. Moved into writing from the press box in 2009, first with Columbus Underground. And then towards the end of that season, I got a phone call from Bob Stein. And he had been trying to form a website that was specifically about the crew. And so myself, Matt Bernhardt, Jonathan Smith, Smitty T-Bone, however you know him, and then Sam were part of that first class, as well as Bob. And I thought Lamacchia came later, but pretty close to it. So that was some of the genesis there, and then Bob kind of moved out of wanting to do that, and I've been running the site ever since. Now covering it for writing about the crew for longer than I for over half the seasons. I tracked that until they had to pause this season.
You mentioned that 2002 Open Cup game. I also remember that being very cold and utterly terrible. But I also remember the soccer being considerably better. And I haven't gone back and watched the full game yet, but I did watch some of the, I started the game that you mentioned is on YouTube. The soccer was not as good as I remember. Now, I was much younger then, so everything was romanticized, I guess, in my mind, but it's hard to rewatch some of those old MLS games, and not just the crew. MLS has done a good job of putting out games on YouTube, classic games as they've called them. And some of those old games are a little painful to review now.
I think that's kind of an interesting, you know, if you followed the league for any length of time, it can be a little bit challenging to really understand how far the league has developed and the quality of player that both teams have. There was some talent on those early 2000s crew teams, but I would say that for the most part, once you get past the top eight or nine guys on those teams, you know, there were some drop offs even in those starting lineups where you'd have some challenges, and the depth of your average squad player in MLS now is a pretty competent player. And it's interesting to see the growth. And, going back to that 2002 game, I'm looking at that. It's like, wow, it's a different age of soccer altogether.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you think about the teams that were good, around that early 2000s times, usually had one or two players that, kind of stood out. And a lot of times, like, the Galaxy or teams like that had aging guys that they would bring in from overseas or from South America. But then, kind of the core players, you needed speed. I mean, there were a lot of guys that were just fast that weren't even really great soccer players, that especially on the wings that could make things happen. And then if you had, a guy who could score and a goalie, I think that was kind of the makeup of soccer back then, at least in MLS. There just wasn't the tactics. I forget who it was, but listening to one of the BSI podcasts recently, and one of the older guys from MLS talking about how, it may have even been Michael Parkhurst, talking about how, they didn't even do film review. I think it was Parkhurst, because I think he was talking about New England with Steve Nichol.
Steve Nichol did not do film. He wanted to get in and out and then move on to golf. And listening to that, it was crazy to think, wow, the level of coaching. Some coaches obviously prepared a little bit more. I think you can see that with Ziggy. I think you could see that certainly with Bruce at times, that they had an idea of what they wanted to do. But, there's so much that's night and day between early MLS and MLS now. Because you talk about the coaching now. If you're just a kick it forward kind of coach, you're going to get eaten alive.
Yeah. And just what's available. I mean, Caleb talked when we talked to him recently, about their scouting that they can do. They have, I think it's called Y Scout, that allows them to watch every game played anywhere in the world that was televised or broadcast on anything. So, you know, they're able to go back and watch. And I've seen some of these, you know, games from, you know, any MLS game that they want. So the scouting capabilities in terms of technology, at least from what MLS has had, certainly grown. I know, you know, obviously other leagues found ways to do that even before the technology was there to have it all online, but MLS just wasn't it at that point. So it was hard. You had to, from my understanding, if you wanted to scout, you had to, you know, go out and make sure you recorded the game or communicated with the team that you needed film and things like that. And some teams just didn't put forth the effort. My next question for you, Patrick, is before you started writing, what are maybe one or two games that you either attended or watched, maybe if they were on the road or whatnot, that really stand out in your mind as big games as a fan of this team that, you know, stand out, I guess?
So I remember this stands out. I wouldn't call it necessarily a big game. This stands out. The 2005 and the 2006 season, 2005 season, 2006, pardon me, when the Crew went through 7 goalkeepers on the roster.
Yep.
And Ziggy's first season. I remember the Crew going into DC in May and giving up 5 goals, and Dan Popick is in goal, and then Dan Popick doesn't That's play amazing. another game in MLS again. He does a favor for Ziggy. He comes out of retirement, gets shelled, and is like, okay, I'm going back to coaching, and re-retires. There was a lot, you know, the 2006 season, there was none of the promise that you look at that team. There wasn't hardly any of the building blocks for that 2008 team, and that was Ziggy just turning over the roster, trying to figure out what was decent and what wasn't worth anything. And most of the players on that team were terrible, who did not belong in a Major League Soccer roster as Major League Soccer evolved. But I always have a special. I remember that season fondly because there's a lot of just bad soccer memories. Because you know there's still some of the hope and of a MLS Cup winning coach coming to Columbus and possibly changing things, and you know the shine wasn't off of that. And it's pre-Scalotto, so you know you're pinning your hopes on Sebastian Rosenthal, and no one should be doing that. No. So 2005, 2006, watching the cavalcade of goalkeepers. I did going forward a couple years. Bad weather always sticks in my mind. 2008, early in the season, I want to say April, it might have been May, and Chivas USA comes to town. Brad Guzan's in goal for them. And it is end to end. The Crew had come out to kind of a solid start to the season. Chivas USA was rising. They weren't a punching bag anymore, but they still were. That was a team that the Crew should be. And it eventually ended up 4-3, and yep. The Crew won. And
April 12th, 2008.
Yeah, I wanted to say it was early, and it was cold and raining and. Sideways. It was terrible weather, and the soccer got sloppier and sloppier, and it was one of the wettest games I've ever seen up until last year's Atlanta game, and it was impressive how they kind of pulled that together. And another one from that 2008 season, there was a losing streak starting with New England at home.
Three games,
and there was a late penalty kick. The Crew start losing, and then San Jose is coming to town. San Jose, I went with my dad, and my dad's not a soccer fan. We would go.
They went to Chivas in between those games.
Yeah, there's
New England at Chivas, San Jose at home.
Yeah, it's I remember that was one of the rare times my dad's not a big sports guy. But we'd go. I bought his ticket. It's like we went. It's like it's not for me, but you know it was fun. you know, he said, hey, you know what, let's just enjoy this. And we did. And the crew won. He got to see, you know, something that, that I was excited about. And then they went on a tear. And that was the turning point. So I don't know if my, my dad was the was the lucky omen, or the fact that that team was just a bunch of killers. It's another favorite memory that, that's kind of more personal than anything that really kind of sticks out from that season. Because yeah, it turned around a losing streak. But you know, when you talk about big games, that Chivas game at home, the San Jose game away, where they just kind of turned things around with a big comeback, the, you know, that, that 2008 team, there's a million stories there. So
well, let's talk about that year a little bit, because obviously the crew just replayed that game. And Sam, feel free to chime in whenever here. Crew just replayed that game last Wednesday, which brought a lot of talk about it. And I don't know if any of you, either of you caught it, but before the game, before they started streaming it, they had Neil Sica interview Alejandro Moreno on Facebook Live. And he had some really interesting things, and I'm going to write something about what he had to say, but just kind of how that, that season came together and how that team really came together as a group. You know, he talked about, he from his memory, and I don't remember if this is true or not, but he said they didn't win a game in preseason. And, you know, other coaches he'd worked with in the past after, you know, that may have, you know, kind of started to think about making moves, but Ziggy was very confident in that group. And you know, that, that gave them a lot of confidence. And then obviously he pointed to, and I didn't remember this, in that Toronto game to start the season, which was a 2-0 win at home, Will Hesmer saved a penalty kick when it was still 0-0. And he said like that gave them a lot of belief, you know, not only in Will Hesmer, who was, you know, still a relatively unknown goalkeeper at that point. But you know that, you know, hey, they could go on and get a goal in that game, and they do, and obviously they win, and so that kind of starts things off well. And he talked about that losing streak, and just how, you know, other crew teams, the crew team he'd been on the year before, would have really crumpled in that situation, you know, losing three games in a row and the way they did. But you know, that team had a lot of resolve, and you know, just really believed in what they were doing. Everybody had their roles, you know, and obviously Scalotto is the one that everyone points to as kind of making it all work. Chad Marshall defensively and on set pieces, but you know, everybody kind of had a role and played it really well. And, you know, they were kind of a collection of guys who weren't wanted by other teams, and they bonded about that. And so I think that, that, you know, crew fans obviously have a special memory of that year, but kind of hearing behind the scenes, was interesting. I'm curious your guys' perspective of that season, and you know, how you followed it. Obviously you said, Patrick, it was the next year that you started writing in the press box, kind of how you followed it, maybe where you watched games a lot that year. What was kind of your perspective on that whole season?
I think I can't remember a home game I did miss. It's trying to think. I watched some from home. I the away games, that is. Ruby Tuesdays, I remember going to D.C. early in the year. They had a Thursday night game when ESPN had the big Thursday night showcase. And the crew, like I mentioned, getting bombed 5-0. they did not do well in D.C. And going into that, and it's Scalotto versus Marcelo Gallardo, the DP from DC, the big import that you know, he's going to change DC around and bring him back up, and you know, they'd face off a decade plus later. But you know, Scalotto, you know, had the best of that, and they run out with a victory. I, you know, that Ruby Tuesday's basement, I watched a fair amount of games there. I remember watching a game in New England that was, I think it was on in the ONN days. I remember it being on a TV that looked like it was from my basement that my dad had kept. That was a black and white TV. That was like a 19 inch. I don't know, it probably showed the 1985 NBA finals that I watched the one year in my basement. The same TV that showed that New England game. But yeah, so there was a lot of belief in that team. And that was one of the things that I was remembering about, that team and everybody having its role, the playoffs. So I remember watching that first game, and I can't for life of me remember where I watched that, because that was on HDNet. It was hard to see, had to go out for it, but I found a place that they were watching it. They were showing it. And that was in the old Community America ballpark. Yeah, and it was a terrible sight. Not a great location for the Crew to play their game. And Kansas City had really kind of taken the game, taken everything out of the game, and the Crew were really struggling, and Len Hart pulled that back and kind of gave that and say, okay, we were the best in the regular season. This playoff run could be something special. And then watching them play Kansas City at home, it had been so long since I'd seen Brad Evans' first goal in that game. And I had forgotten, because I was behind, I think I was above the stage for that game. I was behind that play, and I watched that pass from Eddie Gavin. And it is easy to overlook just how good Eddie Gavin was at making so many plays. He's such an underrated player in so many ways, to make that pass, because that, you know, that broke two lines. There was no reason to look for Brad Evans, who's another guy, which, you know, that's what could have been there. You know, if certain things changed, if they thought, you know what, instead of Adam Moffitt, we're going to say, hey, Brad, you know, instead of Andy Iroh, we lock down Chad Marshall sooner. We don't need to protect Andy Iroh. Maybe we protect Brad Evans, what that looks like. But that, and then those games against Chicago. There was one game that I forgot. You asked about games that I remember.
Real quick, before you get away from Kansas City. So back in those days, I was just starting to get – at that point, I had just recently started becoming credentials. The players are starting to figure out who I am. Ziggy's starting to figure out who I am. Team's starting to figure out who I am. And I would randomly go to practice at Obetz, because practice was open. Like, fans would randomly show up at practice and attend and watch practice. Well, I happened to be up there. It was the day after – the Crew awards night, which was after the last game of the season, and there was a lot of drinking, and there was some it was a great night, but there was a lot of fun to be had. So I go, and I'm sitting in the stands watching the first team practice, and Dave Stephanie, who was the communications manager at that time, he comes by and he goes like, hey, you're not taking any video, are you? I'm like, no, just pictures. He goes like, all right, well, just keep everything down low until after the game. I'm like, okay. Ziggy had actually had the grounds crew line the field at Obetz to the same dimension as Comerica Park, or wherever the game was in Kansas City. So they had to play, they had to practice within that confined dimensions of the Kansas City park where they were going to play. So I just thought that was interesting, but yeah, back in the days when we attended practice.
Yeah. Ziggy would prepare. He definitely didn't fit the mold of a Stevie Nichol type coach. but so talking a little bit, dialing back, coming up and facing Chicago in the Eastern Conference Final, you really have to look back at just how titanic those Crew Fire matchups were that season. For sure. There was no winner in regulation for any of the matches up until that point. They met in the Open Cup, and that went to extra time in Peoria, Iowa. That's right. They played in Peoria. The late tying goal by Steven Lenhart in the summer, I want to say it was a July game in Columbus, to kind of keep the streak alive. There was nothing separating these teams. Cuauhtemoc Blanco really kind of drove an outstanding Fire team that season, and of course Scalotto made things work in Columbus. And so when Brian McBride scores, in the game to go up 1-0, I'm thinking to myself, you know, it's like, wait a minute, this isn't the right script. And, you know, they run out the first half and Columbus doesn't break through. It's not happening. You know, there's chances here and there. And then McBride gets dunked on by Chad Marshall early in the second half. And you talk about the belief in this team. It's like, it's over. That, you know, we got this. As tight as those games were all season, the fact that the 15,000 that were there, everybody stood the entire time and during the game. And, you know, when McBride scored, when Marshall scored, you just knew that the other one was coming, that the winner was coming. And it came, you know, minutes later. And then for the remaining 25 minutes of that game, 35 minutes of that game, Chicago looked out of ideas. They had come up against the brick wall, and not that you want to say we got this in the bag, but looking across the other side in the Western Conference and you have Real Salt Lake, which was a good team. They won the cup the next year. And then New York Red Bull, which they squeaked in,
because of the
crew. Because you had to like your chances if you're Columbus, and it was just one of the more impressive atmospheres that I can remember at a game. I can only think of a top for a crew playoff game once, and I think we'll all agree, 2015 Montreal. that's the only thing I can top it, that I can think that can top that feeling, that energy, because that stadium was full that night. But that 2008 team, once they got over Chicago, it just felt like a team of destiny.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I remember having the same thought when McBride scored. Was just like, this isn't how this is supposed to go. You know, they're supposed to win this, and you know, this is their year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember when they had, when they did the Save the Crew documentary stuff here and had a bunch of those guys back, Len Hart and Andy Iroh were out at practice the day that they were going to show the movie that night. And I just was talking to them and, you know, talking to them about that game in particular. And they said, you know, they went to the locker room and the confidence hadn't waned at all. You know, they were, you know, and those were guys that obviously, you know, would come off the bench and whatnot, but, you know, no one in the locker room thought that they were in trouble. And, you know, it's crazy to think, because obviously Chicago was a really good team that year too. And, you know, had, you know, weren't quite as good as the crew, but, you know, had proven themselves. And obviously, like you said, there was no winner between those games, but the crew just felt, you know, they felt something special. And I think, you know, obviously the fans did as well. And, you know, the rest is history. But yeah, that game will always stand out to me as probably one of the best crew games, if not the best. You know, the championship game was great, no doubt. But I think most people expected the crew to win that one. Like you said, the Red Bulls were the team that had squeaked into the playoffs and whatnot. And you know, anytime you win a championship, it's special. But beating Chicago and the way it played out like that, I think we'll always rank it very high in crew history, if not near the top. So now, shifting forward a year to your move to the press box, how did you, and I'm curious your answer here, how did you kind of view the differences? You know, obviously you're not a rowdy Nordic guy, but how, you know, transitioning from being, you know, in the stands as a fan to going into the press box, watching games from that perspective, you know, the differences, the similarities, how was that transition for you?
To be honest, I probably prefer it that way. Even at the time, it was probably something that felt a little bit more natural. I look at a game. I enjoy watching soccer from an analyst point of view. So being able to watch and write it, this is at the early stages of Twitter. So requirements were a little bit different. The game feeds and all the Twitter updates, it can be a little bit much at times. But it's definitely a different atmosphere. If the press box at Mafre is enclosed, so you don't have a lot of noise. You don't have it's kind of austere environment. You know, it's a workplace. It kind of reminds me of my cube at desk, my cube at work. With, you know, sometimes things are a little bit more noisy because something's going on and there's a little chatter, but for the most part, it's people's looking at stuff and heads down, typing on keyboards, that kind of stuff. And it definitely is a mind shift because you're having to write something out depending on when your deadline is, either immediately after the game, sometimes updates during the game, or you're writing a column and you're either pulling in quotes or you're having to pull up stuff on who scored or chalkboards or something like that to pull up analytics. And it's really definitely a different way of watching the game. It's like live augmented because I will watch games occasionally with my family, and not having access to every review as it's happening, and seeing what's going on. So like VAR decisions, you know, those will still be on TV. Those won't be in the stadium. So it's definitely a different thing. And I'll sometimes get fired up at home a little bit more. But it's funny that when the laptop's out and I'm writing at home in the press box, it's like wearing a completely different hat, and it's kind of flipping a switch actually.
Yeah, I think so too. I think, you know, I'll be interested to see what the press box at the new stadium is like, and if they try and, you know, incorporate maybe, you know, like DC's new stadium, for instance, they can open up the windows there, so you do get more of that feeling of kind of being in the stadium and involved with the crowd instead of behind the glass. But yeah, it does separate you, I think, from the crowd and the atmosphere and that whole kind of vibe that you get. When we talk about you covering games, do you have any specifically that stand out that you've gotten to cover that maybe because you were covering it, you got a unique experience or, you know, a different perspective on things from, you know, whether it be something you learned post game or whatnot, just kind of, maybe stuff that the average person wouldn't have gotten from a game or even an event.
So I think the things that I have pulled out of a lot of my experiences, I can't think of specific games. I do have favorite players coming out of this that wouldn't necessarily pop out in the you know, if you're watching from the stands. And it's usually people who are great to talk to, who have insight, who have a great quote, or something, you know, that have a great view of the game. I remember 2012 for a lot of different reasons. That's kind of another year that sticks out because that doesn't really, it's not really anything as far as results on the field, but, the first game of the season, they actually had an overflow press box because there were so many credential requests. I'm not sure how that happened, but we were put in the overflow press box, which was one of the hospitality suites. And so you could sit outside in the suites taking notes or doing so, which was enjoyable. I actually recall went with Sam to New York, and it was similar to the feeling I had at New York Red Bulls stadium, where if you cover a game in New York Red Bull, you are maybe 20 feet up from the stadium, from the sidelines, right behind the players, right next to the tunnel where they walk out. You're right
basically in the stadium. Yeah, there's no box. It's actually reminds me of how the press area is at the Schottenstein Center, just in a stadium.
Yeah.
So, but it was nice to actually be able to be out and hear the energy. But after that game, And throughout that season, I really learned to appreciate talking to Milovan Marosevic, the attacking midfielder. He wasn't really a playmaker, who came in at the beginning of that season. That was Higuain's first season. He came in at midseason, and he was so refreshing to talk to after every game, because his ability to analytically break down what was happening on the field, what was going wrong. This was during the Mircea era, who his coaching style was much more along the lines of the Steve Nichol scope side of things. So his tactical nuance was, he didn't have a lot of technical nuance. It was very direct. But talking to Marosevic, he oftentimes will have things about how things either broke down or how they were able to make something happen that where Zia often struggled to be able to convey. Where Zia was always a little, he was never able to get his thoughts out effectively in front of the press. That was always a challenge of his. And so Marosevic was kind of that person in the post game that you could talk to. And there was just so much interesting that he would say about how the game happened. And I actually remember a game, August 2012. After Kirk Erso had tragically passed away, the Crew's home game against one of their games was canceled, delayed, and they rescheduled it, and they had a long layoff, and then they were playing the LA Galaxy, and the Galaxy came on a Wednesday, and the emotion in that stadium was something I'll never forget. And to be able to talk to the players afterwards, that to hear what that meant to them is also something I'll never forget. And the other player for a different way of looking at this. I always appreciated Kai Kamara's second coming in Columbus. The 2016 season.
He would let you know what he thought, wouldn't he?
When he was holding out at the beginning of that season for his new contract, and he randomly showed up to practice. he was holding out, but he was still hanging out like outside the team's area. And he just happened to be there because I think he knew the reporters were there. That was weird. And then after the penalty kick, that was,
yeah.
He always said exactly what he wanted to say. Higuain, he was done talking. He wasn't going to talk about it. Kai, right in the center, stood up, talked about it, and the emotion was unvarnished.
Were you in the room? Did you go to the locker room? I don't remember. Did you go to the locker room? So you talked to Kai right after the game.
Yes. Okay. I went in there because I thought people might jet.
Yeah.
Kai was going to get his words in.
Yeah. Because for people that don't know how it typically works, the locker room opens at the same time that the coach is made available in a press conference setting. So Greg came in to the press conference room, but you could go, if you wanted to skip that, you can go and start talking to the players. And so there were only a few people, right, that went and talked to Kai right away.
It was me, because you and I were both there, and it's like, hey, let's split this up. You get Greg. I'm going in there in case anybody jets early.
I think Kinger too, right? Andrew King was
King might have.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kai talked, and then when everybody else came in, he talked some more.
Yeah.
And you know, Higuain, he didn't want to talk. No one else. I think Parkey made some comments because you know, you don't want it to blow up. You don't want your team to fracture like that. Well, you're trying to captain the team, and you know, everybody knew that was kind of the end of that relationship. You know, either they were going to get rid of Higuain, which was unlikely, or they were going to get rid of Kai, they had Ola Kamara. I don't think Kai really liked the fact that Ola was in. It's like, why do you need somebody else? You have me. And that 2016 team was a really weird year. There was just a lot, something that never fit with that team, and yeah. it was strange.
Well, and I've talked to Greg about this off the record, and I think at this point, you know, the three of us have discussed this before, but I think at this point we can talk about this. That team, you know, obviously you have the run to MLS Cup. You're the favorites. You're at home. You know, I think the majority of people, Crew fans, or you know, anyone except a Portland fan, was probably pretty confident in the Crew in that game. You know, if I remember correctly, most of the pundits, so to speak, picked the Crew. And you know, then you lose in such a disappointing fashion with Steve Clark giving up that early goal, and then the ball being out of bounds before you know, they score the second, and the Crew aren't able to fight back. And so I remember, you know, that next preseason, you know, Greg told us after the fact that, you know, guys came in and just weren't in shape. And you obviously have a shortened off season when you make it to the final, and the final was in December at that point. But guys came in, you know, just not in shape. You know, he said there were, you know, specific leaders on the team that just, you know, the first day of their actual training, you know, they did some fitness testing, and guys that normally were, you know, the first ones or ahead of the pack, you know, guys you expect to be ready to go just weren't. And it set a tone very early on of, you know, complacency. And you know, Greg also admitted his own fault that he, you know, yeah, they brought in a guy like Ola, but there were other positions that he felt like he should have addressed. That, you know, and he didn't say this, but I've always assumed that he's talking about central midfield with Tony Chani, because while Tony was good during those first couple of years under Greg, Tony didn't, you know, there wasn't much pushing him, and they could probably have done better at that role. And I think, you know, you saw that at times during the 2015 season, but he didn't want to upset the apple cart, and this is a young coach, you know, not having been through an experience like that before, and kind of learning on the fly. And you know, so they didn't bring in some guys that they talked about, and the team just was very unmotivated to start that season. And you know, you saw that obviously in the results. I mean, you know, obviously the Portland game was kind of to be expected, but then you lose at home to Philadelphia. Chicago, they had three straight games in a row on the road, can't get a result there, including losing at Montreal. And you know, you think you have a win that's going to push you forward with the New York City game, and then again against Houston, and you just can't ever get things rolling. And I know from talking to guys who were on that team, by the time they felt like they had gotten their heads in the right place, they were, you know, just too far off the path. And I think what they finished 6 points out of the playoffs that year, you know, and made a bit of a run towards the end of the season, but they never had it right. Like you said, it never felt like they were able to build on what was 2015, and instead it was, you know, I think expecting it to happen instead of working as hard to get to that point. And obviously the Kai stuff doesn't help, because you have a perfect system with Ethan Finley, you know, almost as a wide forward, using his pace to get in behind Justin Merrim, tucking in Higuain, Kai, you know, getting on the end of balls, you know, and Michael Parkhurst. I think that was probably the year he started to lose a step. Obviously he played well when he was in Atlanta, but you know, with a very different team. So yeah, that's one of the more confusing teams I think I've ever seen. You know, coming from where expectation was, and you know, feeling good going into the season. And I think, you know, the stuff I just said was kind of a reason why. Patrick, let's go back real quick, because and these are things that the three of us have talked about, but when they first hired Greg, you were not a huge fan of that move. Am I correct?
I was unsure. of that move. So when I was looking at the candidates that they had, the one that stood out that I thought early on when Warzee was dismissed in August, I'm like, Jesse Marsh is looking for a job. I've been a big Jesse Marsh fan when he was with the Montreal Impact, when he was in Chivas. There was just a lot about how he prepared a team. I thought he was very sharp. Greg wasn't necessarily on my radar. His time in Europe hadn't gone very well. Jesse checked all the boxes I had. No one called me. They weren't necessarily asking, hey, random guy who writes about soccer, you know, what should we think about the head coach, you know, Jesse Marsh. Okay, well, you know, we'll do that. I just especially liked how he was exceptionally prepared, and how he was able to communicate the game, because he worked when he was not a coach, he worked for MLSsoccer.com, and his columns, his video, his time on TV was always exceptional. He was just very well prepared. So if I had a pick, it was always Jesse Marsh. And then Greg kind of rose up out of this to kind of become the front runner. And so when they introduced him, I was thinking, you know, I don't know a lot about him. I have my concerns about the fact that his time in Europe kind of sputtered out. But I went to his press conference when they announced his, his signing with the team. And I remember having a chance to talk to him, and he had a very similar way of explaining the game, explaining what his methods were, explaining what his ideas were, that he similarly had that ability to be an excellent teacher of the game. Just in very brief conversations with him, it may have been about 10 minutes. I remember turning to Adam Jardy, the beat writer for the Dispatch at the time, who was also there, saying, you know, I think that this is going to be a very eventful hire for the team. I don't know if he's going to succeed or not, but you know, he definitely has a plan, and he can communicate that. And, he was able to execute. It wasn't necessarily, I wasn't a big fan. It was that I wasn't really sure what they were getting. I guess I understood pretty quickly after talking to him. And that's one of the things that I think doesn't necessarily get through in his press conferences. And it's kind of funny. I know that we have talked about it, Pat. The national media, getting to see Greg, covering him for the 5 years that we did, you especially out there at practice and an awful lot more, that he has the press conference style, which is very buttoned down, which is very anodyne, that he will explain things, and he is very generous with his time and questioning. And can be good natured, but then the, not necessarily off the record, but the more on the background, or the, hey, let's just kind of talk about this, that you can really kind of understand how he is able to communicate what his ideas are to players, much in the way other good coaches are able to do. That's why, you know, even when he was struggling here, I didn't necessarily think it was a good idea to replace him, because there were a lot of things that he did that changed. There were a lot of players that played a lot better for him because he understood how to get the best out of them for the system. And so I think that that's where you look at 2019 for Caleb Porter. His coaching style is a lot different. And I think the players struggled with that. Not that it's necessarily anything against Caleb, but it definitely goes to show that Greg is able to design a system that is able to win games, to be as successful as he was, at least in the regular season, as he was over the course of his career, I think is a testament to how he was able to kind of lift up what Columbus was.
you mentioned several minutes ago about traveling with Sam to New York. I know you guys have gone a handful of road trips. Where's one of the favorite places you've gone? Maybe not necessarily because of the stadium or but the overall experience. Just like what, you know, as media member, fan, whatever it is, places you've gone that have really stood out to you for one reason or another.
The one that stood out for me, I loved going. Red Bull Arena is it's just an excellent facility. I have not been out to Kansas City. I haven't been to any of the West Coast venues. I haven't done too much away travel recently because of how the family life is. But Red Bull Arena, that weekend, rode on the bus, did not break down.
did not overflow with crap either.
Yeah, the bus was fine. I rode on.
Didn't take illegal contraband with you?
Nope, none of that stuff.
Not that
the cops found anyway. Not that I found. So unknown. How about that? But being able to go to Red Bull Arena, just the environment there, because I would say that it was 2/3 full, maybe 3/4 full. Not maybe necessarily the troubles that they're having now, but it was so loud because of that roof. And that's one of the things I look towards the new stadium. That roof is just going to amplify that atmosphere. The press box being, you know, just feet from the touchline, the just cans of Red Bull everywhere, and then being able to hop the PATH train, go into the city, grab a drink, and then go to Midtown, meet up at Times Square, and then have to hop the turnstile because the ticket wouldn't take on the last PATH train back to New Jersey.
Yep. A very, very late. It was like what, 2 a.m. as when we tried to come back?
Yeah, it was
pretty late.
Very late.
We should say that was the infamous Rich Bulchin tying goal in like the dying moments of the game.
Yes, the game was a crude draw because Rich Bulchin scored off of Justin Miram assist. That, you know, the high watermark of Rich Bulchin's career. But you know, New York's a good away trip. I went to DC before Audi, and RFK. Maybe if you're there, it's kind of a lovable dump, but crossing
the smelled gang, of diesel.
Yes, it did. It did. I don't know if they stored it there or that's what it ran on or that's what they kept the raccoons away. I don't know. But walking the gangway that connects the concourse to the press box is certainly a different experience. Plus you had to pay for your food. You had to pay $5.
Yeah. I hate places to do that.
We had to pay it at New York too. We had to pay at Red Bull.
Oh, anyway, the food there was excellent. So if I had to pay, it wasn't regrettable. DC was regrettable. Philly is a nice stadium. Just you're stuck too far away.
It's in a dump.
Yeah, I enjoyed went there once, and then been to Chicago. My favorite Chicago trip, again, back in 2011, was a back to back.
The double header.
The double header. So Friday night, Crew play in Bridgeview against the Fire, and then, or was it? No, this is 2010. Pardon me, not 2011. 2010.
Yeah.
And then the following day, the U.S. played Poland at Soldier Field. And so covered the game in Bridgeview, stayed the night, and then went to Soldier Field. And the press box there is way up. And, you know, spent the day in Chicago, which was excellent. And I went out because if you've ever been to Soldier Field, the press box there is on the east side of the stadium. You walk out and you walk across and there's the marina and there's Lake Michigan. So it's right there. And I look to my left and it's Robert Verzia. He's at the box next to me and he's, you know, Poland's his team. And I'm asking him what he thought. And it is just interesting because, you know, we'd been around each other enough that was enjoyable. And that was one of the things I was kind of looking forward to if I could make it happen. was seeing how the fire did in Soldier Field and what that environment was going to look like for them and how that atmosphere is going to be. And I got to put a shout out to Charleston.
That was a good trip.
That was a fun trip. The first MLS Hell is Real exhibition game preseason. Charleston's a fun town. I was actually thinking my wife and I are having our 20th anniversary this year. Charleston was on our list of possible places to go. So it still might. It's in November, so
yeah.
Who knows if travel will be then. But
And the best part about that trip was we had Ralph with us, so we could just, you know, blame everything on him.
Yes. Well, very, very little went wrong.
Yeah.
I couldn't blame the one thing that went wrong for me on him because I was driving.
Ticket.
Yes. You got the old Larry Leadfoot there.
Yeah. Okay. Before we,
hold on. Before you get past Larry Leadfoot, we should talk about how we had to drive back to Columbus right after that Chicago game.
Oh yes. That's
which
right.
I believe we left Chicago at like midnight. And I drove about 4 out of the 6 hours. And then I was like, all right, I can't do this anymore. So Patrick takes over. He's driving, and in order to keep himself awake, he was singing basically the entire way, the last 2 hours.
What was he singing?
I don't even remember. This was 10 years ago, now that I think about it. But he was singing the last 2 hours of the trip.
Most of the people were sleeping.
Until we got back to Chicago.
Sam was, I think, nodded off for there. But my singing will wake the dead. It is not good stuff. So, yes, I was karaokeing it there.
All right, before we wrap this up, I want to ask you a couple of just like, you know, sort of off the wall questions, not off the wall, but just questions such as the strangest crew signing in your memory from your perspective. Or trade, you know, whatever.
I'm trying to think.
Oh, I got one off the bat.
All right, go ahead, Sam.
Because it was so bizarre when it happened. We were in Philadelphia and Jed Zehner got traded to DC United for basically a handshake and a smile. It was just like, I mean, Jed was a fan favorite, even though he was oft injured, but when he did play, he played when Frankie got hurt and he, you know, played quite admirably. So the fact that it just came out of left field that he got traded for basically, maybe not even a handshake and a smile, a bag of peanuts. A lot of fans were really, really, really mad. And it happened, I want to say it was like right before the game, like right before the game against Philly. So like he was with the team and he obviously didn't play that game and he went straight to Philadelphia.
It was him and a fourth round pick for a second round pick.
Yeah. So a bag of peanuts.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's even back then that was not great great deal. that was Horzia era though.
Yeah.
So, the exit interviews from you know, Horzia's tenure were interesting, the players leaving. You know, I talked about Milovan Marosevic. He went back to Chile. I firmly believe that was the fact that he didn't want to play for Robert. He just did not want to do it. So I wondered how that would work out, like him and Higuain, because I think he could have, there was something interesting there. And then, trying to think of any things that made me scratch my head. Robert saving, Scalotto in 2009 in Salt Lake. And once that wasn't working out, not bringing him on for the final 30 minutes or something, I guess that one's the one that I will never quite understand ever. I've heard the explanations. I don't understand it.
Yeah. The trade that always stands out for me, and it stood out at the time because of how strange it was to see this guy in a crew jersey and then how quickly it did not last was Ante Raza.
Yes, I knew who you were going to say. It's like, oh, and it didn't last. Yeah, he did not like Andrulis.
No,
he was an idiot.
He was traded for Tony Sane, who in his own right had his issues in Columbus. But and he had that first game where I believe he had a goal and an assist to Edson Buttle to start the season, and then it didn't work. And I think he was back on the fire by like week four of the MLS season or something like that.
Yeah, did not play for like three straight weeks.
Yeah,
and he was in training. He was done. He was done with Columbus. Yeah, I remember that. That one was. Oh, hey, a goal scorer. That's how's that going to fit? Oh, it didn't. There we go.
Well,
it didn't.
And he'd just been so hated by Crew fans. You know, he'd been on those fire teams that had just ripped out the Crew's hearts multiple times. And you know, you see those from time to time in all sports when guys go to rival teams and how weird it is at first to adjust to that. But that one was just how it played out was strange to me. Your favorite player to watch play in a Crew jersey, and I'm going to take away Scalotto and Higuain because I think those are the obvious answers for a lot of people. So aside from those two, who is your favorite player you've watched play?
I'll go with two, Brian Carroll and Eddie Gavin. I remember preseason in 2008 when the Crew were playing Metapon, and it was at Moffer Stadium, Crew Stadium at that time, but it was not produced by the Crew. It was actually conducted by a third-party promoter who contracted the Crew and Metapon to play. It was attended by like five people. Because it was not in any season tickets, and it was $20 a ticket, and the Toronto Scout. And I remember watching Brian Carroll organize that Crew defense so well, just this maintaining shape, the amount that he was able to talk to people, just his ability to be cerebral around the ball. I've always had a soft spot for cerebral defenders, defensive midfielders. Will Trapp is in that. Group two. But Eddie Gavin, talk about a complete player. So magnificent defensively.
He played goalie for the Metro Stars.
but even as
he played goalie for the Crew.
He did play. You're right. Right.
So even just as a midfielder, his ability to block channels, his ability to step into passing lanes. It was his ability to read the game, his ability to pick out the right pass as a linker. He was never anybody that had the acceleration to blow past somebody, but his close control was excellent. Shot was never the most powerful, but again, he would sneak in goals here and there because he always showed up at the right time at the right place to make the right play. And you know, as I mentioned, his passing, his ability to pick out that goal for Brad Evans in the Eastern Conference semifinals, that he was really a complete offensive player, just a step down from like a superstar.
And he had a great red beard, and I have an affinity for great red beards.
He did.
Him and I actually had a conversation about that before the 2008 MLS Cup when they had that like pep rally thing out at Easton.
Could you hear his response?
Yes. Well, I was standing right in front of him, talking to him one-on-one. So yes, in that situation I could. Now your favorite game, and this will be the last one I'll ask you, the favorite game you've ever covered. It doesn't have to be a Crew game, because I know you've covered some US games and stuff too.
Yeah, I haven't covered U.S. national team, so I will pick one from each. My favorite U.S. team covering a U.S. game, Mexico is just a different beast altogether. But Jamaica in 2012, the Jamaican contingent was there in the press box in green and yellow and cheering.
Nice.
But the atmosphere at that game was just a fun game. And my favorite game to cover for the Crew, just for all of it, was that Montreal playoff game. It had everything. It had a team that was to the edge. It was a team that had missed its opportunity. It was, the penalty kick denied, the comeback on the goals, and then the extra time winner. The eruption in that stadium was just was something else. You could sense an energy about that that team and how the fans were reacting to it. It was just something that you rarely have seen in Mafre, for better or for worse. And I'm kind of interested to see what the new stadium turns into.
I was really hoping you'd say the 2015 MLS Cup, because we you and I had quite a great time.
I did,
despite how it played out.
I did enjoy certain parts of that. And the funny thing about that game is that, much like Portland closing out that game, was the opposite of how the 2008 Eastern Conference Finals happened. Because for the last 30 minutes, I looked at that as like, there's nothing happening. It's done. You know, Portland has an answer for all of those things.
It was Justin Merrim going 1v1 against everybody, because they had no other ideas. He went, as I said to you at the time, he was going full Kobe Bryant mode. He was just going to try and do it himself, and that did not work.
It was interesting to see. It was a fun match to cover, even though the result did not go the Crew's way.
Well, and just the build up to it, you know, everything that they had here in town. I think that was when you heard from Precourt the night before at 4th Street about Omar Gonzalez.
No, that was not. That was actually ahead of USA Mexico.
Oh, that's right.
No, I'd heard Higuain resigned.
Okay, that's what it was.
I did not hear about Omar Gonzalez. So 3 weeks beforehand, I'm rolling out of 4th Street. I had just talked with DJ Switzer of Wrong Side of the Pond, and I'm walking out. I'm like, okay, I'm done. And Precourt's rolling in. I'm like, I'll catch you later. I'm gonna chat with Precourt for a while. And so I of course have a certain sense of style, and so I'm completely overdressed for 4th Street at a pregame event, and overdressed for being a reporter. And so Precourt's there, and one of his friends is there, and I'm hanging out with him, and it looks like I'm hanging out with I'm part of Precourt's posse, and I'm just chit chatting with him, just kind of talking off the record, nothing that I ever used in a story, about things, about how he liked being, liked what it was to be a sports owner, and I think it really colored how the Save the Crew event happened. My sense of how Precourt is that he always liked the idea of being a sports owner, and always liked the adulation that came with it. And when it wasn't working, I think that was the big struggle for him.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was necessarily personal, but I think he was always thirsting after that.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. Once they get it rolling in Austin, assuming we ever have live sports again, which hopefully we will here in the not so so distant future. So this is kind of how we're going to roll with this podcast here for a while. We're going to have some different guests that have massive report connections, one way or the other, on for a while, and hopefully we don't have to do it, you know, too long. But I think it's an interesting way to kind of pass the time, while, you know, kind of reminisce about some things, talk about some Crew memories, hear from people maybe you don't hear from as much, and just give something to listen to while we don't have much to talk about on the crew front. As far as we know right now, the team is not going to play, at least until May 10th? Is that the most recent
date? Officially, it's May 10th, and the training moratorium is already out 3 weeks, so I would have to imagine that May 10th date is it's written in pencil, and right, they have the eraser standing by.
Yeah, and obviously they're going to need some sort of training to get back into form. I don't know if you need a full length preseason, but you definitely need some time to ramp up after this long layoff. So, we'll obviously continue our coverage on Massive Report. We're trying to be creative in terms of stuff to write about, without the obvious, and whatnot. But, you know, and we'll provide any information as we learn it in terms of what MLS is thinking and, you know, hopefully when we get a return to the season and how that's going to look. So Patrick, thank you for coming on. I know, it's been busy, as you detailed earlier, with the family and whatnot. But we appreciate it. And, Sam, as always, thank you for handling things behind the scenes. We'll try. I know we were off last week. We were just trying to coordinate between the three of us and it didn't work very well. We'll try and get another one of these out here in the next week or so, and try and do something roughly weekly for these with various people. It's just coordinating with the various guests. So we've already got a few people lined up that are interested in coming on that I think will be interesting. So hopefully here in the next week or so, we'll have another show. But thank you guys. I appreciate it. This is fun. It's nice to reminisce and hear some of your stories and even some of the stuff that, you know, predates me and how that all works. So thanks again, and we'll catch everyone soon.